You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, President Trump and some of his allies say there's a deep state in Washington trying to undermine the Trump agenda. We'll find out more about the makeup of a deep state and whether there is one in the United States.
First, Governor Walker announced his two-year budget proposal last month. Since then, lawmakers have been reviewing the governor's plan for taxing and spending in Wisconsin.
Recently, the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, a nonprofit public policy research organization, took a closer look at plans for spending on education, transportation, tax rates, and other priorities.
They have a new report out, and Todd Berry joins us now. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, big picture, how does this budget change spending in terms of how much money we're spending, how much of a surplus, that sort of thing?
Well, in terms of all money from all sources over the next 2 years, it would be about $76 billion from only the general fund, which is the budget we usually think about, the budget that's funded with state tax revenues, around $34 billion a year. It's not inconsequential in a state economy of annually $250, $300 billion a year.
And so how big an increase is this percentage-wise over the previous budget?
If you look at what we are estimated to spend this year and what we would be spending in the second year of the budget, it looks like the increase will be 8 to 9%, which compared to prior budgets is a little larger increase than what we've seen in recent biennia.
And we're coming out of the current budget, you write in your report, with a decent surplus, some money left on the table, if you will. What happens to that money in this new budget?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we thought we were going to have a surplus by June of around $100 million, and they got some nice surprises in January. And so now they're looking at about $450-plus million balance. What they end up with at the end of the biennium in mid-2019 is a surplus of about $80-plus million, and that amount gives us a little bit of cause for anxiety, because in terms of what we're spending per year, that is less than a half of 1%. So if anything goes wrong with the economy, terrorist attack, oil shock, just about anything, you could see an $80-plus million surplus disappear in a matter of days and weeks. And so it's definitely tightly balanced. I wish I could say this was different than prior budgets under this governor or the prior governor, but the answer would be no. We tend to do this almost every budget and cut things really close and don't leave enough balance to protect ourselves.
Right. There's a lot of kind of known unknowns, if I can quote Donald Rumsfeld here, including, I mean, they have to estimate what we're going to get in revenue. That includes things like sales tax and other taxes, which is hugely dependent on what happens in the economy. Looking at what this budget estimates as far as economic growth over the next couple of years, does it seem at least realistic?
Well, if you look at the annual growth in tax collections, what we thought they were going to be last November was around 3% per year. And this revision ups that to about 3.4% per year. So it's not a dramatic increase in the growth rate, and compared to prior years coming out of the recession and right thereafter, typically our tax collections would grow 4% or so per year. So even a 3.5% growth in tax collections is moderate, but it's certainly not unusual, and it's nice to have the extra money, but it doesn't suggest that the state economy and the tax collections are suddenly going hog wild, so to speak.
Talking to Todd Berry from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, they've been digging deep into the governor's budget proposal, looking at what it could mean here in the state. You know, another variable federal support for healthcare spending. if you've been looking at the headlines, Todd, that could change a lot soon. I mean, how much can we even account for that at this point in the budget process?
Well, and in the governor's proposal, he really couldn't, in fairness to him, because the proposal that has come out of Washington in recent days was under development. Medicaid is the state's primary health care program for low-income individuals and disabled and often seniors. The state puts $3 billion or so a year in it. The feds chip in the majority, so if there's too much swing in what the federal government is putting in, particularly if it goes down or doesn't grow, that is going to come back to potentially cause a little bit of trouble in Wisconsin.
I want to get into a couple specific budget issue areas. Transportation spending, road building, road maintenance has gotten a lot of attention, not just in this budget, but the last one, too. When you look at what the governor's laid out, what do you see? What do you like? What are you worried about?
Well, the overall expenditures are rising a little bit. It's sort of, though, depends on what you look at. The biggest growth item in the DOT budget over the base is not highways or local road aids or vehicle enforcement. It's debt service, and that has been the problem in transportation in Wisconsin for the last decade or so, and that is the prior governor and this governor have both increased the amount of borrowing for transportation, and that is coming back to bite us in terms of having to pay off old debt, which cuts into the kind of money we might have to do construction or repair.
And then let's take a quick look at the K through 12 education budget. Governor looking at an increase. There have been cuts, of course, in recent years. It's a very complicated formula, the way we collect taxes locally, send them to the state, send them back to the school districts. What do you see in our K through 12 budget?
Well, I think most school people view the proposal favorably. It does represent growth in money that will actually go to school districts in the next 2 years, and it's a fairly significant amount. What I think is a bigger question is how the money is being distributed, and that is we aren't really putting much new money in the big general school aid formula. The new money is going in sort of a side payment that's based on per pupil dollars, and that has been where the action has been in the last few budgets. And this gets to be real sort of insider baseball, but in effect, we're developing a second school finance system outside the major general equalizing aid formula, and school finance in this state is terribly complicated, and we just seem to be adding more and more bells and whistles to it.
Before I let you go, Todd, I want to ask about rainy day funds. That's been a concern for you, whether it's Governor Walker, Doyle, McCallum, Thompson, however far back you want to go. Are we making any progress on having that rainy day fund so we're ready when a recession or whatever hits?
Well, it's important to distinguish between this rainy day fund, which can only be used in the case of, you know, an economic emergency, recession, and so forth, as opposed to just the ending surplus, which is what protects us in the short run. The rainy day fund in Wisconsin sits at around $280 million, and the governor has suggested raising that by $20 million, so it would go up to around $300 million. You have to sort of look at this in context, because while $20 million is being added to the rainy day fund, they're spending down $370 million in one-time surplus. So in terms of the total cash the state could access in an emergency, you could argue we're going to be worse off at the end of the biennium than we are at the beginning, even though a little more money is going into the rainy day fund.
We'll leave it there for now. Todd, I'm sure we'll check back in. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Todd Barry with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, looking at some of the nuts and bolts of Governor Walker's proposed budget.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as the new health care bill was unveiled, a Republican lawmaker caught flack for saying that people who are low income should invest in their health care over purchasing items like iPhones. We'll take a look at poverty in the United States. Our guest says iPhones aren't what's keeping people in poverty.
First, President Trump and some of his allies in Washington have been accusing the bureaucracy there of harboring a deep state or a group of government employees who are actively trying to obstruct the Trump agenda.
That term, deep state, has before now mostly been applied to countries like Turkey or Egypt or Pakistan, where an authoritarian faction might try to interfere with a democratically elected official.
Peter Fever joins us now. He's a professor of political science at Duke University and the director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Peter, let's start with the basics. What is a deep state?
A deep state is the phrase that political scientists developed to explain situations in countries like Turkey, like Egypt, like Pakistan, where they have the formal appearance of a democracy. They might have elections, they'll have candidates running for office, winning and losing, but that democratic form is within pretty narrow boundaries. And if the political leaders try to transverse those boundaries, try to do something very, very different, the national security apparatus intervenes to restore retake control, then put in place another government that would stay within the boundaries. And so it could take a form as a coup. Pakistan has had multiple coups over the years. Turkey and Egypt have sort of stayed within certain boundaries until Erdogan, of course, transversed those boundaries, faced a coup, and is breaking free of that so-called deep state.
So does this mean that a deep state sort of intrinsically suggests a group working to undermine democratic principles?
Well, it is really describing a state where they don't have a full democracy yet. They have a partial democracy, and so there's a certain amount of space where democracy can operate, and then there's other things that are out of bounds. It doesn't describe well the situation in the United States. Of course, we have a robust democracy, what I think President Trump is talking about when he uses the term is he really means something very different from what political scientists mean when they talk about the deep state.
All right, and what does he mean?
I think what he's referring to is the age-old frustration that every president has felt, which is that you may be the most powerful person in the world, but that doesn't mean that you can get your will done in every particular, because you are sitting atop a vast bureaucracy that is slow and cumbersome, that is filled with people that have their own agendas. Some might be personal agendas. Some of them might be bureaucratic political agendas, wanting to improve the status of their department over someone else's department, their budget share over someone else's budget share. And all of these, you depend on these people to implement your policies, but they also want to shape and move and would like to do things in a slightly different way. This is bureaucratic politics. Every president has wrestled with it. Every president has complained that his policies are being undermined by the bureaucrats in some way. And I think that's what President Trump is talking about.
Right, you mentioned other presidents, and Nixon has been mentioned in this context before as having been frustrated by what he saw as agency efforts to undermine him, for instance. What happened in a case like that?
Well, Nixon experienced an acute form and you know, of course, left under a cloud. But it doesn't have to culminate in that. Lots of presidents have had lower-level officials that have operated at contrary purposes to theirs, and when the official goes too far, the president fires them. And lots of the presidents have had lower-ranking officials leak to do in damaging ways, and when they find out who that is, they fire them. I don't know if you remember, but in 2013, there was a guy on the NSC staff, on President Obama's national security staff, who was tweeting under the name National Security Wonk, NatSec Wonk. And he was tweeting basically from inside the White House. He'd walk around the halls of the old executive office building and tweet out critiques of President Obama. They finally found him and, of course, fired him. But that kind of thing happens. Every president has had to deal with it. And the modern communications age has leveraged it and given those kinds of folks a larger mouthpiece, a larger bullhorn.
Is there a point at which maybe some of these government officials who might have a different point of view, been instated by a different president, at which there's a critical mass of these people, or there's a certain type of organization among these people, at which point you might say, okay, maybe this is resembling a certain kind of a deep state?
Could it exist in theory? Yes, it could exist in theory. Does it exist in practice in the United States? I don't think so. I say that even though in the administrations I served in both the Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration, I can remember cases and describe cases where the president was trying to pursue a policy and lower-ranking officials were resisting it and making it hard to do it. One good example was the freedom agenda that President Bush was trying to implement, and many of the regional bureaus in the State Department did not like that emphasis and dragged their heels on it and were slow to implement it, and the president was frustrated with that. And of course, President Clinton was very frustrated when the Defense Department didn't push back on his proposal to open up the military to openly serving gays and lesbians in 1993. And the Defense Department pushed back hard against that. So presidents have found these moments where they're pushing a policy and the bureaucracy pushes back. And some presidents, President Clinton in particular, lacked the political clout to impose their will. And they have to make compromises. And I think President Trump is experiencing maybe a little bit of that. And what intensifies it is that the Trump administration has been slow to put their people, their political appointees, in the lower sub-cabinet positions. So right now you have a few political appointees at the very, very top, and then they're looking at a large federal bureaucracy with almost no political appointees at the, you know, squad level to help implement policies, and that's exacerbating this problem.
We're talking with Peter Feaver right now, political scientist at Duke University, talking about the concept of the deep state and whether there is one in the United States. Our guest says, no, there is not. And it is a term, though, that we have seen used pretty frequently, and it's been used for a couple months now, I believe. The New York Times has talked about it. The Post, Breitbart has talked about it. Is there any risk with a sitting president using this term, or does it drive home a political point?
Well, this is the year, we're actually on year two of what I would say the years of hyperbole. So if you think about 2016, it was a year in which hyperbole replaced common political discourse. Everything was extreme on both sides of the aisle, and also all forms of commentary were describing their opponents in the most extreme terms. And I think some of the deep state rhetoric is another example of hyperbole. The danger with hyperbole, though, is that it alarms. Of course, that's what it's designed to do. It alarms and creates an atmosphere of anxiety, and in particular, an atmosphere where crazy conspiracy theories can flourish. And there's enough serious problems going on without crazy conspiracy theories muddying the waters. And so my concern is that people will chase the conspiracy theory rather than focus on the serious problems, and thus get diverted from addressing the real challenges that the country faces. And so that's why I'm reluctant to use that language to describe what is a more common and understandable challenge that the Trump administration faces, namely how to get the bureaucracy to move to implement the Trump agenda. Every president has wrestled with it. The best presidents figure it out. I think this president is in the process of trying to figure it out. And if he does figure it out, I think he'll be far more successful.
Do you think, Peter, that we'll stop hearing about it, or has it become useful in a sense that because it is, as you say, a loaded term, it could have the effect of maybe pushing back one's political enemies and getting them to retreat a little bit?
Well, like other hyperbolic terms, it does put your political or policy opponent on his or her hind feet. And so I do see the rhetorical use of it. So maybe we will keep hearing it. But it's not an accurate description of the challenges we face in the country. And so I think it's misleading. He's not the only president to use these kinds of hyperbolic terms. The sainted President Eisenhower used the term military-industrial complex back in 1961 in his farewell address. And that is a hyperbolic term that some might consider to be equivalent to the deep state. And I think it was an exaggeration of the challenges Eisenhower was facing.
And we leave it there, Peter. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Peter Feaver is a professor of political science at Duke University and director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Joined us there to talk about the concept of a deep state.
Coming up, we'll talk about poverty, healthcare, iPhones, and why poverty is about more than individual choices. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA with a look at the gray areas in divisive issues and the people who have trouble taking sides in political confrontations. Tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, congressional Republicans unveiled their answer to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, last week. As GOP lawmakers went to the public to advocate for the plan, Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz made waves after answering a question on CNN about the health care plan's accessibility for low-income Americans.
Americans have choices, and they've got to make a choice. And so maybe rather than getting that new iPhone that they just love and they want to go spend hundreds of dollars on that, maybe they should invest it in their own health care. They've got to make those decisions themselves.
According to the 2015 census, more than 43 million Americans lived below the poverty threshold.
Stephen Pimper joins us now. He teaches American politics and public policy at the University of New Hampshire, and he's the author of the book, A People's History of Poverty in America. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, you're someone who's an expert in public policy surrounding poverty in particular. What did you make of Jason Chaffetz's comment?
Well, I mean, sort of setting aside the fact the math doesn't quite work out too terribly well if you go that far, it struck me as a very, very sort of common kind of way we have of thinking about poverty in the United States, right? That if you would simply alter your behavior that is within your control to be less poor, if you need health care, you need to be more responsible and make more informed decisions. And were you to do that, you would be able to either bring yourself out of poverty or to be able to afford health care.
And what do you think is wrong in your estimation of viewing poverty like that, something that looks more at poverty as an issue of priorities and maybe issues of personal grit?
Right, as sort of a matter of behavior rather than sort of other large structural forces. I think for me, the reading of the social science, and we look, you know, across disciplines, the answer is that because that's not what we know about how to explain most people's poverty. And of course, right, it's a nation of 320 million people, so it's very easy to find anecdotes of about anything that we would like to. But if we look at, you know, now we've got, what, four decades of really sophisticated research about the question, what we find that best explains poverty is often the accident of where you were born and to whom, a host of structural factors that are typically beyond people's control, like the state of the job market where they live or the quality of their local schools and how well that prepares them for higher education and upward mobility, the things that government does or doesn't do. And then finally, and this is the thing that I think Americans in particular have the hardest time dealing with, how much of poverty and mobility and well-being is simply luck, either good luck or bad misfortune.
And you write that there's also a sort of intrinsic belief that most people have that they will not be in poverty, that's not likely to be them. What are the odds on that?
Well, the odds, unfortunately, are not great. And this is, I think, part of why people have such a hard time dealing with this is that the data that we have available tell us that a lot of that sort of core American dream myth, the idea that if you work hard and play by the rules, that this is a land of opportunity and upward mobility is available to you, is not borne out well by the evidence. And in fact, if we look at the Census Bureau's own data, just over a three-year period, somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% of all Americans will have their income slip below the poverty line for at least 2 months or more. If we look at work by Mark Robert Rank and others, he's at Washington University in St. Louis, over the course of our lives, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60% of all Americans will have their income fall below the poverty line. And remember, that's about $24,000 for a family of four. More than half of us will have our incomes drop below that line for a cumulative total of a year or more. Poverty in the United States is actually fairly common and radically more common than it is in other rich democracies.
And you mentioned the foundational American belief in what we call the American dream, which has been hugely important to our concept of who we are as people and as a nation, this idea that if you do work hard, you can fight your way up and have a better quality of life. And it's all about the hard work. But how does the United States stack up when it comes to upward mobility?
We don't fare quite as poorly as we do if you look at poverty numbers or childhood poverty numbers or elderly poverty numbers, where we tend to fall toward the very bottom of the pack among rich democracies. That's sort of the depending on how you do the math, 26 to 30 something comparator nations. In terms of mobility, there are a very large handful of nations where if you are born poor, you're much more likely to rise up and have your income rise than we are. It's true in Canada. It's true in New Zealand. It's true in Australia. It's true in France and Germany and Spain, depending on which sets of numbers you look at. It is certainly true across the Netherlands. It's certainly true across the Nordic countries. It is, in fact, this notion of this land of opportunity. If we look at pretty much any cross-national data set you want to examine, there are a long list of nations in which upward mobility is much more legitimately a part of your experience than it is here. And I think that's really hard for Americans to come to terms with, precisely because that has been so essential to the story that we tell not only to the world, but the story that we tell ourselves about who we are.
We're talking with Stephen Pimper right now. He teaches American politics and public policy at the University of New Hampshire, also the author of the book A People's History of Poverty in America. And going back now to that story of upward mobility that has been a cornerstone of the country, it seems as though it's also been a bit of a cornerstone in policy as well. If you look at some of the stories, for instance, and policy that happened under Ronald Reagan, looking at, for instance, what he called welfare queens and the idea that some people were coasting, but other people were working hard. How do ideas like that play out, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think particularly in the Welfare Queen actually goes back to when Reagan was governor of California in the 1960s and is something that became a central part of what's often called the Southern Strategy. And this was an effort that begun in the 60s and 70s, but sort of ramped up in the 1980s of Republicans to try to woo working class Democratic voters who they thought they might be able to pull over. And they were looking particularly at sort of lower income white working class voters who were struggling and trying to figure out a way to appeal to them. And a lot of those wound up being thinly veiled racist appeals. And the idea was that the explanation of the Southern Strategy was to say to those voters, we understand why you are not feeling well. We understand why things are bad. Things are bad because of those people. And in the 60s and 70s, that was particularly geared toward African Americans and particularly African Americans on welfare and other kinds of benefit programs, always relatively small expenditures, by the way, but as a way to say, this is what's happening to you. This is where your money is going. These resources that could otherwise make your life better are going to these undeserving populations. And oh, by the way, those are all policies and programs supported by Democrats. You should come on over to our team and vote Republican. And this, you know, we've got a whole lot of evidence. Lee Atwater, a strategist from the 1980s, actually went on record on this. And of course, you know, bless his heart, Richard Nixon, because everything was on tape. We have a pretty extensive record of the ways in which Nixon was explicitly thinking about targeting welfare and criminal justice policy and racializing them in order to create an enemy to use to mobilize voters.
And looking at that iPhone comment that we began with as, mm-hmm. as maybe an extension of other ideas, for instance, that if you're on food stamps, you shouldn't be buying steak, for instance, is something you write about. And right. in this case, or an iPhone, if you're getting other entitlements, you say that maybe that's for you. You don't see that that's necessarily something a person who has entitlements shouldn't have. What do you think about that idea? If you're getting what some people might term as a government handout, that you shouldn't be buying a luxury item.
Well, I mean, I think the first point that I made is we get very selective in our way of thinking about what constitutes a government handout. And, you know, someone who perhaps might be living in subsidized public housing, we're comfortable making judgments about how they should live their lives. But I happen to benefit in much larger amounts from a home mortgage tax deduction, which is also a housing subsidy. But people don't tend to feel entitled to make judgments about how I spend my money. So I think we get very, very particular about which kinds of government assistance we single out as marking you as undeserving. The second point, I guess, would be that if we look at, say, the USDA's own study of the food stamp program and other kinds of research that's been done, is that, you know, most of those kinds of stories turn out to be myth. Most people on food stamps say use their food stamp benefits in the same way that most Americans use it to purchase food. So, you know, is there, you know, soda and junk food in their cart? Sometimes, yeah, but in no greater amounts than there are for anybody else. And the idea that there's this widespread profligacy of people on the program, there's not evidence for, and it doesn't make a lot of sense because you, in fact, need to be very poor indeed to qualify for those programs. And if we trust that people generally are fairly responsible, especially when they've got children in the household, for the most part, people are treating those benefits with care. And then the last point that I would make is that there is something that strikes me as, never quite know what the word for is, that uncharitable and even in a funny way sort of unchristian about the ease with which we make those kinds of judgments of people and the surety with which we expect people who are poor to be miserable. And the idea that, you know, if you are, you know, a single woman on welfare working two part-time jobs and raising kids and you have just had the week from hell and the thing that is going to make you feel better is a nice cut of meat and a baked potato, I feel really uncomfortable begrudging another human that little bit of joy and pleasure in what might be a really difficult and unpleasant life.
Stephen Pimper is with us right now. He teaches American politics and public policy at the University of New Hampshire, and he's with us to talk about poverty in America. and why he says it isn't as simple as choosing healthcare over, for an example, an iPhone.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What did you think about Representative Chaffetz's comments that people should invest in healthcare, not in an iPhone? How do you think we should address poverty in the country? Are you now or have you ever lived in poverty? What kind of choices did you make? Did you feel like you were judged for some of the choices you made? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Stephen Pimper is with us now. He's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America. And we're continuing our conversation about poverty in America and why he says the way Americans talk and think about poverty undermines the issues facing millions of people nationwide.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about poverty and policy in the United States? How do you think we should alleviate poverty? Have you been there? Are you there now? What would help you? What didn't help you? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We have John first in Racine. John, hi.
Hello. Thank you for putting this topic on the air. I think it's real important. I think it's one of the biggest divider that I see between my red friends and my blue friends. It's just an unquestioned attitude that, you know, we have these welfare cheaters and that some people are getting away with everything, and therefore I need to vote for, say, Trump or another conservative who shares that belief that he can't. And so I wonder, are there other, but there are a lot of organizations putting out that type of information to people. Are there any other, are there organizations that are putting out the message and the facts that the gentleman has just presented? How does that factual information get out to the public? Because it doesn't seem to come out very often.
John, thank you for that. And what do you think about that? Is information, for one thing, being available in a bipartisan way that we can agree upon the facts, Stephen?
Yeah. I share John's frustration on that question. I joke because, you know, it's sort of my colleagues and I who do work on poverty. We talk about the poverty season, and that's when the Census Bureau new data on poverty come out in September or October. And we know that that's a moment generally that people are going to be interested in talking to us. But the rest of the year, we're constantly fighting, if I'm honest, about sort of getting people to pay attention and trying to get focus on this issue. And, you know, there are lots of individuals and organizations struggling to do the same thing. I know that, you know, a lot of the problem is that it is complicated, right? We live in a very complicated world and a very complicated economy, and different people are poor in different ways for different reasons. So it becomes very easy to tell a simplistic narrative about fraud or abuse, about you being taken advantage of. And there are instances of that, right? I mean, that's absolutely real, although no evidence that it's more than trivial kinds of numbers. But to tell that more complicated story of what is, for me, often about insecurity, right? About the sheer number of Americans who often are doing okay, right? They're struggling really hard consistently, but the mortgage is getting paid and kids are getting clothed and fed, and maybe they've got an extra 100 or 200 or 300 in the bank for an emergency, but all it takes is for one crisis to happen in their life, an unexpected illness that they can't afford to pay for, a car that breaks down that requires $1,200 to get back on the road that they don't have and a friend of theirs doesn't have, and that causes them to lose a job. I mean, it's really easy to slip into a spiral. And part of why it's easy in the U.S. to slip into that kind of spiral is precisely because our public supports are so much stinsier and so much harder to access than they are in those other countries that have much lower poverty rates and much lower levels of insecurity. It's not precisely responsive to John's question about sort of where to go for information. I don't know that I've got a good concise answer, if I'm honest. I, you know, sort of the dozen places that I go to regularly. I think the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities produces pretty good analysis in D.C. The Economic Policy Institute, which is a little more in the weeds, but still, I think, generally accessible to folks, is often good. And the Congressional Research Service, which produces reports, and this is not the CBO, who you've been hearing about a lot in the last couple of days. The Congressional Budget Office just does analysis of budget items. The Congressional Research Service is the private research arm of Congress that doesn't publicly release their reports. But if you Google them, you can actually find some black sites that publish their reports. And those are really solid, smart, straight down the line policy analysis, trying to explain the effects of public policy and who benefits and who loses.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. And we go next to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I just wanted your guest to comment. I mean, our own governor, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and his majority controlling Republican legislature have proposed to test welfare mothers and welfare families. You know, people on the lines of state or federal AFDC to be drug tested. My comment is one of the greatest beneficiaries in terms of billions of tax dollars, both federally and statewide, are farmers. And we're not just talking to family farm. We're also talking to corporate farm. And therefore, shouldn't we both drug test low family farmers and executives of corporate farms in all sense of equity? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Jim, thank you for that. And he's looking at some possible legislation here in Wisconsin, perhaps to drug test, not something that's happening right now, but it was on the table last time around to drug test people who are getting some of these public benefits like food stamps.
Yeah, and I share Jim's sentiment. I would not propose expanding drug testing. There have been a couple of states that have in fact conducted such experiments in the recent past. Florida was one, and I'm not going to remember the exact numbers, but they spent an enormous sum of money running all of their recipients through a testing process, and I believe they came up with one positive result over the course of this experiment at some enormously large sum of money. And again, this is sort of built into that myth and that stereotype, right? That the people are on welfare because they're lazy and they're undeserving and they're alcohol and drug addicted and there's something fundamentally irresponsible about being in need. The evidence doesn't bear it out. And I would imagine that were Wisconsin, and there has been some court decisions that have ruled that these are actually, I should take that back. I'm not sure it's court decision. I think it's the Department of Health and Human Services that has determined that those kinds of tests are a violation of the federal food stamp laws. But were Wisconsin to impose similar kinds of policies, I would be very surprised indeed if they didn't come up with similar results, spending very large amounts of money and not discovering anything. And the last sort of point I'd make on that is that if there are, in fact, people on food stamps, people on welfare, people in public housing assistance with addiction problems, then the answer to that, of course, is not punishment or making their economic lives and the lives of their children more difficult. It's expanding access to treatment. We know what works. Unfortunately, we know that the kinds of treatment that are most effective are fairly expensive, and those tend to be the resources that states have a harder time mustering public outrage on behalf of.
And we're just about out of time, Stephen, but given what you just said, I mean, is it rational to want some of the people who are maybe needing some of the benefits we're talking about for insecurity to funnel them into a job and to gear some of the entitlements toward that, just briefly as we wrap up?
Well, I mean, most food stamp recipients are working, and a very small majority of the poverty population are actually non-working adults, under 20%. So part of, again, this goes back to sort of we misunderstand who the poverty population actually is in the United States. And by and large, and again, there are exceptions because there always are, most people would prefer to work because that brings it with it all the things that we all get from it, right? It begins with dignity and with a sense of worth and a sense of deservingness. Most people value that. So the idea that we got a large chunk of the population trying to shirk it, again, simply not borne out from what we know.
Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Stephen Pimper. He teaches American politics and public policy at the University of New Hampshire. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.